All right, thank you for tuning back into The Human Occurrence. I'm your host, Brent Phipps. I'd like to start off, as usual, by acknowledging the traditional custodians of this land, past, present, and future. Our guest on the show today is Biralee Pateson. We go in depth with her about her grief journey and the death of her mother, Niecy. Niecy Pateson was a really incredible woman who demystified death in the Northern Rivers. And it's a bit of a different episode, this one. So as always, guys, get ready because this is going to be a ton of value. You're going to really enjoy it. And let's discuss death. Here we go.
Good to be here.
I want to, so where did you get your, because I was going to ask you yesterday, where did you get your passion for bees? Was it before Flo?
From working with Flo, basically, I've learned so much about bees and beekeeping. It's been awesome.
Have you got any bees? Yeah.
No, I do have some up at the office, but not at my place.
Right, right. Yeah. Do you have the intention of getting any or?
I would like to, yeah, maybe springtime.
Is that the time to get them?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's the start of the beekeeping season in Australia.
Right, and
spring. Yeah.
Is it similar to like the growth of plants, right? I'd imagine it would be.
Yeah, totally. Well, the springtime is when the hives are starting to thrive and the nectar flow is happening and there's a lot of forage around for them available. So they start kind of multiplying and
Yeah. And then what happens in winter? Do they just hibernate? Winter
they kind of hibernate. I mean, around here it's not so bad because there's generally a lot of forage available all year round. But generally in winter, the hive kind of, you know, you leave all the honey in there for the hive. You don't harvest and they just sort of do their thing and hibernate and just live off the honey that they have stored. They generally build up a bunch of stores before winter.
And then that lasts them.
Yeah.
Right. That's interesting. Hey, so you know how yesterday I was talking to you about I was stalking you a bit?
Yeah.
Well, I was really interested in hearing about the state of Jala.
Yeah, so that's my little kind of side hustle that I've got going on. So it's basically just a platform. It's basically my website and a platform that shows all of my work as far as content writing, feature writing, copywriting, all of that. So it's basically kind of my business, but it's an all-round creative platform for me.
Cool.
Where I can sort of show my commercial work and also show my blog posts and all that sort of stuff.
And what does Jala mean?
Jala's my middle name, actually. And it means ascending little goat in Arabic.
Ascending little goat. Ascending goat.
Yeah. And it's, I think it has a few different meanings in a few different cultures. I think it's got an indigenous meaning as well, but yeah, so that's my middle name.
Right. And your passion for writing, Where did that stem from? Where did that talk to us about that? What's
kind of been, I guess, my skill from a really young age. My mum was really into writing as well. I kind of excelled in English in high school, and I've just always really had a knack for words, and that's kind of what I love doing. I'd say it's probably my creative passion. So I did a degree at Deakin in Melbourne, which I majored in journalism and professional creative writing.
Great.
And then I went on to work for a magazine called Willem, which is based in Denmark. So I did a lot of feature article writing for them.
Yeah.
Since then, I've also done a lot of copywriting for local businesses like Rowie and Bandicoot, a bunch of different people around Byron, just basically writing their web content and, web bios and that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm kind of trying to work up a little freelance business with State of Jala.
I love the name. It's really catchy. It's really catchy. And when you said, did you say you're going to commercialize it or you do commercial work?
Well, I mean, as far as the copywriting, that's basically writing web content for commercial purposes. So that's like the bios or, you know, rewriting people's product descriptions on their website, sort of thing. So that's kind of the commercial aspect. But I guess my passion is more in creative feature writing, about different artistic people. If you had a bit of a look at the website, I've written about quite a few different artists and I find that super interesting. And then poetry as well is what I'm into. But That's right. Sort of my thing that I keep hidden away from everyone.
So would the commercial side of it be the bread and butter?
Yeah, basically,
Of the business, yeah. There's a lot of that, yeah. Where the other side would be more the juicy stuff, more the creative side, more you.
Yeah, that's right. And I've done a lot of writing for Wellham, but there's not a whole lot of money in feature article writing unless you kind of get with a really big magazine or company. A lot of writers do tons of that for free, basically to get your work out there and get a name.
Right.
Sort of build up the profile, but unfortunately there's not a whole lot of money in the creative side as much, I find.
Right. Why is that?
I don't know. I think a lot of magazines, like a lot of writers just submit free articles unless you work for quite big sort of companies. Like Wellham didn't have much money, you know. We were basically just trying to get started, and we, you know, published a few hard copy books and that sort of thing as well, but it was more like a project of passion for most of the writers.
Yeah, got you. Is Lisa Messenger in that industry? Have you heard of Lisa Messenger?
No.
Right. She does stuff with, you know, she bought out a magazine and books and all that sort of stuff, a publishing company. I think it was like 5 years ago, but I'm a big fan of her. She's like an entrepreneur and a really empowered woman.
Yeah,
and,
right. I'll have to look her up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
But so when I, cause I reached out to you and I was, you know, it wasn't funny, but there was a lot of similarities between our journey from your death journey and mine. And, I knew of your mum's name's Denise, right?
Nisi. Denise, but was always
Nisi
for sure.
Nisi, yeah. Cause I saw a lot of her through the documentary, as I told you. But I, when mum died, and I wrote some really, really deep posts about that, about death and all that, I remember you commenting on it, and we kind of connected through that. But yeah. I wanted to see if you could talk into, because I really want to get to know your mum. As far as I know, your mum was a palliative care nurse. She did a lot of work in that industry. And then obviously your dad's Paul, right?
Yeah.
We've got two Pauls. Yeah. My dad's Paul as well. And he used to get involved in like the coffin making.
Yeah. And also painting, because he's an artist. So he used to paint a lot of the coffins, and mum was quite into promoting the cardboard coffins because they were a lot cheaper.
Right.
You know,
right.
In the funeral industry, there's big money in it as well. So
it's huge money.
You know, some of the coffins, they're trying to sell them for like 20 grand or, you know, it's quite full on. So they were quite into promoting the, the cheaper options, but yeah, your story and your post really resonated with me. Mum, would you like me to tell you a bit about mum's whole story?
Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah. I'd really love that.
Yeah, yeah. So she kind of started, as a nurse many, many years ago. And then she did a welfare course, and she actually worked as sort of like a death doula at the palliative care unit for St. Vincent's Hospital.
Right.
So she worked there, I think, for about 4 years with the dying, mostly dying cancer and AIDS patients. So she basically supported them through their death, would, you know, give them foot massages, kind of like counseling almost, was just somebody there to kind of give them love and warmth and help the family as well.
Mm.
So she was present at a lot of deaths as well. You know, she was in the room for one guy where the whole family saw like light shoot out of his heart when he actually passed over and things like that, which are pretty interesting. So she kind of did that. And from there, she went on to get into the funeral industry and become a celebrant, and did that for many, many years, and was kind of revolutionized the industry a bit in the North Coast. She was extremely popular and well known for the work she did, because she really promoted, like, tried to just move away from the typical kind of, she tried to demystify death and move away from the kind of morbid, like, and the whole church thing, and do a lot of alternative funerals. She was really Buddhist. She'd been into Buddhism since her early 20s and did, you know, tons of retreats. And we had a lot of influence from Tibetan monks and Japanese Zen monks and throughout our life. And she was really into just kind of, creating more of a beautiful celebration and ritual for the person rather than this just morbid,
you know, way of doing it.
Thing. Because in the West, it's like people are sort of in denial about death. It's not spoken about so much compared to the East, where it's such a part of life, like it really is. So yeah, she went on to work, and she, you know, did quite a few, she did some documentaries and worked with Zenith a lot in a few different areas. She was incredibly well, like, sought after basically in her field for this area. And so then when she, you know, went through her journey, it was, it was pretty interesting, really. She, was diagnosed with cancer first in 2015 and found out she had cancer in her bowel, and it was quite manageable at that point. It hadn't spread, and she had surgery in 2016, but had a big complication with the surgery, ended up in hospital for quite a while. And then it was a year and a half later when we thought it was sort of all done and she was on the mend, she found out it came back in her liver. And by that point, it was like pretty much beyond, even though we tried everything.
So did it started in her bowel?
Yeah, it started in her bowel and it hadn't spread at all. So they cut it out and basically did a pretty major surgery. But after the surgery, she got like an E. coli infection in her abdomen, and the hospital didn't really cotton on to it for about a week, and it almost killed her. She ended up being on IV antibiotics for a month and lost all her body weight and got really, really sick. And then she recovered from that. And yeah, basically after that was just, you know, working on trying to get her, get weight back on and get her health back up. And then it was, a year and a half later that once we found out it came back in her liver, I think all of us deep down probably knew that was probably going to be the end. But, you know, obviously you do everything you can and you go into complete survival. Like, you know, as soon as we found out, we did a GoFundMe, we raised like $12,000 overnight, basically. We, you know, got her into the Cassia Clinic as well. And she did that treatment for a while. And I think it was about, you know, and we tried all the CBD and we tried a whole bunch of alternative things. She didn't want to do chemo. But by that point, the liver tumors, I think, were too far gone to even really do chemo. The doctors were like, it's basically palliative. But we were still fighting, you know, she never really gave up hope. I think deep down she knew, but she was still trying everything. And at that point, like I, you know, was probably their main support person. I've got two brothers, but they're in Brisbane and they weren't present as much. So I was kind of the main person doing so much research. I was spending hours and hours and hours of like researching different treatments, you know, like just trying everything I possibly could. And and we, you know, sort of tried to fight it. But I think after a couple months passed, we started to realize it was, you know, we weren't winning the battle and she was just, you know, deteriorating basically. And you know, at that point I started to go really internal. I started to read the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which was helped me a lot through that whole process. You know, mum's Buddhist influence and just to try and come to terms with it and let go. Like we had, you know, obviously a really strong connection, as I'm sure you did with your mum. Like we were very, very connected and you know, her and I were probably the closest out of everyone. And you know, it was absolutely devastating. It was just like, you know, felt like the whole world was, as you would know, it's crashing down. And but at the same time, it's this weird portal where your heart's sort of broken open and you're in this space where you are sort of more connected to the divine or source or something, you know, because you're so raw and open. So it's kind of this mixture of like the most intense pain you've ever experienced, but it's also really beautiful in a lot of ways. And like I was so grateful we basically got the time to actually really say goodbye and spend those last months, you know, rather than if something just suddenly happened. And you know, it was very hard on my dad. She was at home the whole time. He was her full-time carer and, you know, basically doing everything. I was helping a lot, but in the, you know, final once I kind of just sensed it was coming close, I kind of stopped work and just went and stayed with them. And by that point, mum was going really internal. And she actually said to me a week before she died, she said, oh, I'd really like you to record my life story, because she had a really interesting life. She went and she left Australia. She grew up in Sydney and left Australia at 18 and lived all over Europe and London. And did all sorts of crazy things, and but we never got that chance, which was a bit of a bummer. In the final kind of, once I realized it was coming close, I went and stayed with them, and you know, it was pretty intense and confronting. I had some pretty full-on moments happen that I think I dealt with a bit of trauma just from her being so, you know, by that point she was completely emaciated, and you know, a few things happened that were pretty full-on. And you know, my dad and I just every night would lay in bed with her and hold her hands and just tell her, you know, you're surrounded by love and light. Just really, you know, she was so amazingly, amazingly strong through it. That's the thing. She just really, she had such a calm spirit, my mum, and she just really, like, once she knew, she just kind of went, right, okay, you know, I'm just going to kind of go internal now and I know what I need to do. She wasn't really grasping to hold on. She was kind of just so kind of strong about it, as much as she, you know, didn't want to leave us. And my little brother also was pregnant at the time with his partner, and that was the first grandchild, which was pretty devastating as well, because she never got to meet him, and it was kind of like, you know, things like that. But her and I, you know, said a lot of things to each other, and obviously, you know, there's always guilt. So much guilt stuff comes up from, you know, teenage years and all of these things I said to her. And like, as much as we loved each other, we had, you know, the typical mother-daughter battles and, you know, working through all of that stuff and trying to just let that go and forgive myself. And, but yeah, and then in the final, like, days, basically, when we knew it was close, my dad was sort of sleeping in the same room as her, but not in the bed. And she was conscious right up to the end. She wasn't taking much morphine. We were giving her a tiny bit sometimes at night, but she was really present and there. And the night that she passed, my dad came and woke me up at about 1 a.m, I think. And she'd woken him up in the night and basically instructed him to sit her up. She's kind of, you know, could hardly speak, but was like, you know, sit up, like pillows behind my back, really quite direct and forcefully. And he, you know, was so, he sort of said, oh, you know, it'll hurt to sit up. Why don't I just roll you over and rub your back? And she's like, no, sit me up. And she, you know, got my dad to sit her up and prop pillows behind her back. So he was sort of holding her. And then he said she just took about 10 really labored breaths. And then just went like that, was just gone. And he was just like, and so he woke me up straight away, and I went into the room, and he was, you know, just in awe of it, because he said it was actually the best gift she could have given him, rather than, you know, just waking up to her gone. It was kind of like he got to see, basically experience her spirit leaving.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, put crystals all around her body and put lit incense and spent the whole night basically just sitting with her. And it was the most crazy energy. Like, it was the most elated, warm, beautiful, loving energy in the room. Like, it was so sad, but also so beautiful. It was, yeah, really bizarre. And from the book I was reading, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, what they say, like, the Tibetan lamas often do when they die is they sit upright, because your spirit can leave through your crown chakra. It's got an easier exit point. Right. And I was like, that's what she did. I'm sure that's what she did. She's like, right, it's time to go. I've had enough. Like, sit me up. I'm going to go now.
That's incredible.
It was really incredible.
It's really hard to describe the energy, right, when you're laying with a loved one, especially, you know, a member of your family of origin. And to be in that space, it's something that you can't really describe until you do it. At what point did you know your mum wasn't going to make it? Like, was it at the point of, like, when she first got diagnosed, before the cancer went into her liver, or was it at the point of the liver?
It was the point it came back in her liver. Like, I really thought, when the first time round, I really thought she would make it through that. I was like, no, she's strong enough. And I feel like what happened in the hospital with the infection really nailed her immunity. And it kind of, if there was any little cancer cells left, it gave them the opportunity to thrive. I mean, who knows? Like, we were quite angry at the hospital for a while, but you kind of have to let stuff go. And, you know, but once it came back into her liver, it was interesting because the night before she told me, she didn't want to tell us kids straight away. I think she just tried to digest it for a few days. And the night before she told me, I had this really like profound dream of her where she was just a little bit younger, and she wasn't doing anything particular. She just looked really glowing and beautiful. And it was almost like this vision. I woke, and then the next morning I spoke to her and she told me the cancer had come back in her liver. And I knew, like in my spirit, it's mm-hmm. like I knew, and I was so, so devastated. And as much as we went into survival mode and just really tried to...
you there?
All of us, that we knew that was probably it, yeah. We knew that was like, yeah, probably the end. So from there, it was, yeah, a 4-month journey. And she deteriorated quite quickly, like as far as the weight falling off and getting really nauseous and sick. Obviously, as you know, with liver, it's pretty horrible. Mm. And, you know, the hardest thing was just watching her suffer for those last months. And I think she probably could have held on a little bit longer, and we were kind of expecting her to go into a coma. But I think by that point, she actually kind of decided she'd had enough. And I feel like she consciously went, I'm going to leave now. Like, she was at that point where she was kind of slipping into the other realm already. Mm. And I think, you know, we'd had a bit of an awful experience the night before she died where, you know, she was demanding to get up and be taken to the bathroom because, you know, at that point she was so emaciated and weak that she had to wear adult nappies and that's the thing. And she demanded to go to the bathroom. She didn't want to. So my dad, Paul, helped her in there. But then we had just with this whole drama, she kind of got stuck and we had to like carry her back out. And I think after that, my mum was really dignified and really like, I think, you know, the whole thing of having people looking after her, she's hated it. And I think after that, she kind of just, you know, went, this is enough. And the next night just left her body. It was, yeah. Yeah.
Was your mum the type of woman to put a lot of other people first?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Her whole life, she did that. She was just completely selfless. And even in the funeral industry, just dedicated so much more, went above and beyond, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I can, for my journey in that with my mum is that, you know, I believe that she really established that cancer because she was so, she was so like in awe of like giving everything to everyone else.
Yeah,
and she really struggled to put herself, you know, first and give back to herself. Yeah. And yeah. I know that she was working on that for a lot of years. But I, you know, in my belief system, what I kind of witnessed, I really feel like that was the reason why she kind of got the cancer, and the lesson was from that for our, you know, all the people that played witness to that was that, you know, my beliefs are, is that, you know, I need to put myself first before my kids, before my wife.
Yeah.
Because, you know, how can I love or have a full cup if I'm not really putting, you know, giving that.
Well, that right. It's like when you're in an airplane and the oxygen comes down, right? You need to put it on yourself first.
That's right.
It's a similar thing, but mum really neglected herself in that way. She was like such a dedicated mum, so dedicated to everybody else. And just, I feel the same as well. I think she just kind of like pushed herself and neglected her own well-being a lot. It's, you know, it's bizarre. It's the biggest, one of the biggest things you'll ever go through, obviously. It's just when it's your mother too, you're just so psychically connected, like, you know. I mean, obviously I'm really connected with my dad, but your mum is a really different thing. It's
completely different when you're homed in a body for 9 months. Genetically, there's just something different there. But I'm really interested because what's your beliefs around when they leave? Because my beliefs are, is that there's certain people, not people, but spirits or whatever, that come down to help them transition. And the reason I say that is because I had an experience in the hospital with my mum when I stayed a night with her before we took her home. And, She was really deteriorating and losing weight. She couldn't walk. So, you know, I had to take her to the toilet and all that. But there was a moment of when I took her to the toilet, and then when I took her on the way back, she stopped me and looked me in my eyes and said, "Can you see him?" And at that point, like, I got that cold feeling through my whole fucking body. And it was funny, before I woke up to mum needing me to get her to the toilet, I had a feeling, like, I've had a couple of experiences in Bali that there was something present there, and I had that same feeling. But when she said that, I said to her, "No, I can't see him, but I can feel him." And then when I put her back into her bed and she went back to sleep, I could see in my psychic space that her grandfather was there, Wilfred. But what's your beliefs around that? Do you believe that there's that spirits that come to help them transition? I think I've lost you. Hello?
I've got you back now. It just disappeared for a sec.
There you go.
I totally believe there's spirit guides or ancestral lineage that are helping them transition. I absolutely believe that. The night that mum died too, or the next night, I had this really vivid dream that, so we've got this Tibetan monk friend, Lama Tender, who's been a part of our family for a really long time. And mum used to help organize a lot of meditation retreats with him and did a lot of different work with him over the years. And the next night after she died, I had this vivid dream that Lama Tender had her on a table and was like trying to help her. She was sort of waking up, and then he was like holding her down and gently kind of helping her go back to sleep in the dream. And I was like, maybe his kind of spirit, even though he's still alive, is somehow helping her in that realm. And at her funeral, he came up. So after she died at home, and one of mum's requests was she didn't want to go to the mortuary. I think after working in them, she was just like, I want to stay at home. So Zenith brought over a cold plate, and we had, which is like a, basically like a big metal plate that plugs into the walls, like a freezer. And we put her on that in bed, and we kept her at home for 5 days. That was the maximum legal limit. And so during that time, multiple family members and friends came, and we, you know, sat with her and all of that sort of thing, and it was really beautiful. We had her surrounded in flowers and crystals, and we sort of watched her body change too over the days, you know. It was like the first day or two, she really looked like she had a bit of a smile, and then after sort of day three, it was like, no, her spirit's really leaving now. It was like kind of, and then so we basically took her straight from home up to the crematorium where we did the funeral, and then Lama Tender did a whole kind of, it's called a puja ceremony, where he, you know, it's just helping her spirit transition and move on and leave her body. So that took about 15 or 20 minutes. He did this whole chanting ceremony for her, which is, just helping her to go and not kind of, they call it the bardos in Tibetan, you know, in Tibetan culture, where it's basically you've got to kind of go through this whole series of realms to get, and then potentially be reincarnated or whatever. But so that was really interesting too.
It's so nice to have so much ritual around death, and you had that opportunity because of her belief system and your family's belief system and all that. Do you think that if you were to be in a situation where you were dying, well, we're all dying, right? But if you had a disease or something like that, from your mother's experience, do you think, how do you think that would be different for you in terms of not having that experience?
It's hard to know how it would be for me. I mean, it would, but I feel like she showed us such strength in it. And I definitely feel like I don't have a fear of death anymore from watching her die. Like, it really changed things for me and for my dad. I kind of feel like, you know, that whole fear around what may or may not happen is, it was actually quite a beautiful experience in some ways, you know, as well as so intensely, deeply painful. I Yeah, I mean, I feel that I have an acceptance of death, and if that were to be happening, I would. The main thing I think is not resisting something, because that causes so much more suffering if you can have an acceptance of it. You know, but who's to know how, you know.
That's right. I think it's like any new experience, right? It's it's hard to know until you're in it. But I think that from, you know, your experience and mine, I think that, you gather more tools in your arsenal. So when you do it, if you are in that position, that you'd be able to, you know, hopefully adjust a bit easier to that moment. Because, you know, prior to my mum's death, I had a lot of like undealt fear around death, and I didn't really know it until I started to go through the process with mum. I think that's, you know, there's so many gifts that come out of death, and you know, I am so different. I am so different.
I've been thinking about you guys a lot, actually, but I mean, it was a little different for me because of the work mum did for so many years. I'd already been sort of introduced. Sorry, this is just trying to turn my phone.
You're popular.
I put it on silent, but it seems to be connected to my.
That's all right. It's a nice Bing.
But yeah, you know, I'd seen a lot of dead bodies over the years. I've actually had a lot of friends die over the years, and I'd kind of been introduced to that area of death through mum already. But I still had a fear of it, like everyone. And I definitely feel like since watching her process, it changed something. Absolutely.
Yeah. How old were you when she started to work in palliative care and all that?
I must have been quite young. Like I must have been around 10 or 12, I think.
So
I think I saw a dead body probably for the first time when I was about 12. And, you know, that a lot of people are quite freaked out by that as well, but it's actually quite a amazing thing. And it's quite important to be able to see that finality and, you know, it's not a scary thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And your mom, you know, when I saw her on the documentary, I was really intrigued by her eyes. And there was like, it was weird because I saw her and I initially thought, I went, fuck, she's got some really deep depth about her. And then there was a moment in the documentary where she described that she could feel the when she would like dress the bodies and work with them, that she could feel them and feel that spirit being around. And totally. she used to talk to the bodies.
Yeah. Did,
as a girl and your mum being in that industry.
Yeah.
You know, what was that like? Like was that.
Yeah, it was kind of bizarre in ways, and sometimes we're like, wow, my mum's like in a mortuary. Like she would voluntarily do mortuary work when she didn't actually need to because she sort of liked it.
Right.
And she was a very kind of wise, quite psychic woman, my mum, and she definitely had a connection with the spirit world. I think spirits kind of like were drawn to her. She had quite a kind of comforting, calming thing. Like at the funeral home, she would even, you know, if babies died and that sort of thing, she would hold them. She'd just walk around carrying them and that sort of thing for, you know, an hour or something, or she would spend time talking to them and trying to connect. And she also, my dad used to actually joke about it. He'd say, oh, you've brought too many people home with you, Niecy. Like, I think he used to feel the presence at home, that some of the spirits that were maybe a bit lost or you know, had died really suddenly, would kind of attach to her as some sort of comfort figure for a while.
Yeah.
And she's had a lot of interesting things over the years. Like when she was younger, she had a boyfriend die quite suddenly in a motorbike accident, and she said his spirit came to her in broad daylight a few days later and told her he was okay and all this stuff. And she's had, she's always had a bit of a psychic ability, my mum.
And your discernment would have to be pretty strong, right? Because it's all well and good having a really strong psychic ability, but in terms of discernment and how you described like her coming home and Paul, you know, feeling those people, you know, I'd imagine working in that industry, you'd have to have some sort of like practice to actually kind of not cleanse, but detach. And did she have something like that?
Well, Not so much. My dad and I used to talk about that actually, because he'd say, you know, you need to just kind of sometimes put up a bit of a protection barrier to not have all of your energy drained, because she'd get so drained from work and she'd really work herself to the bone sometimes. And, you know, I guess her Buddhist practice, she would do meditation rituals and things that would maybe help that space. But I feel she was maybe psychically and energetically drained a lot by her work. And I feel like even so much she gave to that could have contributed to her, I don't know, maybe, you know, just kind of deteriorating a bit over time or.
Yeah. I got you. What are the biggest gifts that death has like given you from your mum's passing? Like, because it's obviously transformed you, right?
Yeah, I would say the biggest gift is more of an appreciation of people in life and not getting as caught up in the menial trivial stuff, which is once you go through it and you're like, this is fucking real and this is so raw, and it just kind of brings you to that brink of reality where it's like all of the menial shit just doesn't really matter. It's, you know, it really kind of wakes you up and jolts you into this like, you know, you just realize how kind of dumbed down and numb we can get through the trivial things in life. And I feel like that's probably the biggest gift. And, you know, me and my dad have really, like, we're so, so close now, you know, where obviously I'm his kind of rock, and they were together for 40 years as like, you know, your parents, and they were still very much in love, you know, they were, they would have, you know, been together forever kind of thing. And, so that's been super hard for him, and I'm kind of his main support person. But yeah, I took him out last year for a kayaking trip in the bay.
Yeah.
We wanted the tours, and we took some of mum's ashes with us actually.
Right.
And it was like the whale tours, and we got out past the Cape, and we were like, okay, we kind of paddled away from the main group, and we said, oh, let's, you know, put some ashes in the water. So we poured some ashes in and sort of swirled them around, and both of us sort of half jokingly were like, come on, give us a whale, niece. And no joke, like 3 seconds later, this massive whale, like so close, just went woo out of the water. And we were just like, what the fuck? We couldn't believe it. It was awesome. It was so amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the gifts for me is that, you know, for me to play witness to the devotion my dad and mum and the love they had for each other was so next level. It was so fucking beautiful. And witness that was just like, that was such a gift for me. That was such a gift. And it was so beautiful to see how love can really be transformed in that way.
Well, that's right as well. I had so much more respect and was in awe of my dad for what he did and how much he just devoted himself and the love between them to the very end. And he even said he was like, it was an honor to be, you know, doing things like changing nappies and all, which is was pretty awful for her. But all of that, he was like, I would do it again in a heartbeat. It was such an honor to be able to nurse her through that. And their love was just so incredibly deep. And it was kind of hard because in the last few weeks, she sort of withdrew from us a bit, and I got it that she just was going really internal. But I also kind of, as much as I wanted my time with her, I had to also respect that they were having their time of saying goodbye and letting go after that many years of being so, so connected. Like, you know, when you're with somebody every day for 40 years or whatever, like, you know, me and my mum were super close, but I'd also been living away for a good 10 years or more. And, you know, like it was... It's very different for him when it's the person in your daily reality every day, you know?
Yeah. How's your dad now?
He's a lot better. Yeah, he's a lot better. The first year was brutal for him. It was really, really hard. And I think for both of us, after 2 years, the grief took a massive turn. I feel like it took 2 years for me to come to a really different place with it. Because, my mum's mum died a year after her as well at 96. So that also happened, and which was kind of a relief at that point. But, he's doing a lot better. He's started to get out more and socialise, and he's kind of, you know, open to potentially dating now, which that just wasn't even at all in his sphere for the first 2 years. Like, it will be coming up 3 years this October. October 13th. So he's in a much better place. It's not as raw, and it's you know, we still have moments now where, you know, we can go into that grief and it can feel like yesterday and it can, you know, feel super raw, but generally it's not, yeah, it's just, it's in it, it's moved to a different place somehow. It's like, it's always there, but it's not, you know, the first 6 months I cried myself to sleep most nights.
Yeah. No, I can relate. Like, yeah. It really brought me to my knees, but it really installed a really spiritual practice with myself and a really true connection with myself. No longer did like money really play a part. And for so many years, I was just chasing money and just stuff that really didn't matter. But on the dad subject, like with my dad, he, I really do hope in the future that, you know, he does find love again, because being 63 is still young.
Yeah, well, he's same with my dad. Like, he's 66, but he's still vibrant and young for his age, and he's got so much life left. I really hope he finds another partner too.
Yeah, and that would be, I couldn't even imagine that, right? Being with someone for that long and then having to, like, psychologically get your mind around, oh, wow, I could be with someone else, or...
That's right. Well, it's such a trip for him, because he's like, wow, I'm in my 60s and now I'm having to looking at dating, and you know, he's never going to have what he had with mum. Like, that was his sole connection but I hope he, you know, even a companion or lover or somebody that he can just share things with, would be awesome. But I think he's slowly getting to that point now.
Yeah. It takes a bit of time. And you said you had two brothers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. How are they going?
They're okay. It's really different. Like, I'm super emotional. They're not. I know they would be dealing with it in their own way, but they don't really show their emotion as much. And they kind of are both the types to just get on with it and just, get really busy with work. And I think they're okay. Like, I speak to my younger brother a lot more than I do to my older brother. And he's, busy. He's had a baby in the last couple of years and he's sort of very busy with that. And he, I think it's hard for him, but I feel like it really tore me to the core. Like, I don't know I'm sure that it's, hurt them as much, but it really broke me for a while.
Yeah. Well, it's because your relationship with her. That's why.
Totally.
Yeah. And, I don't really, I do believe in broken hearts, but like, as you mentioned at the start, like how it broke you open, that really feels right for me, because when I initially, I was like, oh fuck, my heart's broken. But when I really felt into it, it was just another level of me opening up.
Yeah. Well, we joke and call it heart breakthrough. We're like, heart breakthrough. I guess.
That's a good way of putting it. That's a really good way of putting it. So, Biri, where do you see yourself in the next couple of years?
I'd like to kind of get my creative skills and writing and stuff happening a bit more. I feel like since mum died, I just kind of, everything was such a blur for the first year, and it's just kind of went into that survival mode a bit. And I'd like, now that I'm coming out of that, I'd like to kind of focus on creative stuff a bit more, potentially. Like, we'll see what happens with the whole family thing, whether that kind of path happens.
The family thing.
As in starting a family or whether that's kind of the path as well. But mainly I want to kind of, I'd like to really like to do a meditation retreat. I'd like to kind of go a little bit deeper into my spirituality, focus on trying to be happy,
Yeah. Kids are
to my spirit, and
kids are a really good way of getting deep.
Yeah.
I find I was really naive prior to kids, and probably
I'd be interested to know, for somebody who had kids through the whole experience, how that kind of changed it for you, because you've got something else that really is your focus before yourself. You know what I mean? You have to kind of, like, that's your priority, like whether that was a big change compared to, say, your sister, or whether as far as dealing with the grief, I don't know.
With kids, do you mean?
With kids or without kids, yeah.
Right. Well, like I said, like, I think that I put myself first, and I think a lot of people dig their heels into the ground when I say that, especially my male friends. Like, what are you fucking talking about? Like, that's really
Yeah, right.
My whole theory is, like I said, like I need to put myself first, make sure my cup's full before I can actually move into that. But in terms of having kids around death, like that was such a gift for me. As confronting as it was, for us, we were really practicing honesty rather than deceit. And I think a lot of parents can kind of go into a place of like, okay, let's not tell the kids anything about that. But what they don't understand is, or maybe they don't realize, is that kids understand all this, regardless if you tell them or not. They feel it. They're such little pure vessels. So having my boys around mum and telling them, you know, that she's not, you know, she's about to transition, she's dying, and you know, being around a dead body was, fuck, what a gift, you know, like, you know, they're going to grow into men that, hopefully will be really emotionally available, but, have such a strong sense of death, and a good relationship to it. So it was a gift. It was confronting. It was really something that I can't describe, that you know what I'm talking about.
Totally. Yeah, it was really, I mean, my mum had the exact same philosophy in funerals and stuff, is to really, you know, involve the kids in it as much as possible. And when we had her at home for the 5 days, like all of my cousins' children who are quite smaller came, and the kids were just so amazing. It was just so amazing. They'd come in and they really got it, and they'd sit with the body, and there was no fear, and it was just like so incredible to see. And my dad actually lost his mum from cancer when he was about 10. And back in those days, he grew up in Texas. And back in those days, the kids weren't even allowed to see the body. It was all just swept under the rug. And he had so much, you know, suppressed grief and trauma from not being able to deal with it properly. And his mum just sort of disappearing one day. And just, you know, she was sick for a couple of years, but it wasn't, they were very much kept separate. And it just was really damaging to him. So it's so important.
It's normal. It's so normal. But like you described before, it's like, it's so quick. Let's not talk about it. Usually next to someone that who's sick, and then you're at the funeral, and then you're at the wake, and then you're drinking or numbing or something like that. So for me, it just like, fuck it. I'm so interested in death.
You know, in
the whole process around it, just because I did Zen's courses and 5 years before mum died, and mum was actually do all that. Yeah. But it's just like, for me, like I never really realized that, you know, because I'm going to dive into the death industry, I never really realized that was going to be my path. But it just needs to, the conversation needs to change, and the relationship that we've got around death and grief needs to change in this world, because not just the world, but especially our country, right? Because you know, the Aboriginals, and you know, they had like death and sorry business, and they really process death really healthy. Ceremony around it for weeks on end, and it's just really beautiful. But for some reason, it's just really unhealthy to sweep it under the carpet, right?
Absolutely.
If you're not willing to acknowledge it, I think in my belief system that eventually you're going to have to, because you're going to die.
That's right. There's
going to be a point of you going, okay, well, I'm transitioning, I'm dying. Either it's going to be sudden or expected. And that's a gift with expected, right?
Sorry, go.
Oh, it's the same with expected, is that you get the chance to say goodbye. And yes, it is confronting through watching the body break down and all that kind of stuff, but you do get those really special moments where sudden is like such a huge thing to adjust to.
I can't imagine.
You know?
Yeah, I can't imagine how much sudden would rock you. Like having that time, that process to say goodbye was really healing. And I was going to say, like in Buddhist culture, that's one of the main things, is keep death at the forefront of your mind at all times, because it makes you sort of live and appreciate your life and not, you know,
doesn't
actually
it?
Just go for it, because it's fleeting, you know.
Well, it brings a lot of like presence into your life. It forces you to be here right now. And that's what I'm thankful for. Like, I never thought that, you know, I'd say like one of the greatest gifts is my mum dying, you know? Yeah. And if I had the choice, this seems even crazier. If I had the choice of having her back or being where I am now, I wouldn't change anything.
Yeah.
And that's fucking nuts. Cause you know, if I said, you know, well, I'm sure my sisters will be listening to this, but I'm sure that some people would want her back.
Yeah.
But there's so many gifts from it.
Well, that's amazing too. And I feel I'm at that point now. I felt like at first for a while, I was really kind of like, why, how did this happen to me? You know, like a bit of victim mentality. And now I feel like I'm at a place where I'm like, no, this has made me so much stronger as a person and in my spirit. And, you know, if like, I feel so much more resilient to what life has, because we've basically just gone through the biggest thing that you could be faced with. Other than, you know, like obviously the death of another family member would be hard, but it's like your mother is, you know, it's a really a feeling of like, okay, if I can get through, if I can survive that, I can survive anything. Because when I first found out, I actually had this feeling like, I'm not going to survive this. I was actually like, how am I going to survive this? I'm just not going to. I'm going to crumble. I'm going to have a complete breakdown. That's going to be it. And it was just so, so amazed by the strength and resilience of your spirit to just, when it's happening, you do just cope. You do. And you, it's like something you thought you just wouldn't be able to cope with, you know. It's like, yeah,
it gets your skin a lot thicker. Like, you know, I used to like, you know, if I pranged a car or something, I was like, oh, that's the fucking end of the world. And now it's like, it's a grain of sand, right?
Yeah, totally.
Hey, Berry, thank you so much for joining me. We've got to wrap it up because my little boy, I can hear him crying in his cot.
Yeah, cool.
But I really appreciate you showing up and being vulnerable, because, you know, the amount of people I've asked to step into this are like, thanks, but no thanks. And I totally get it. I totally get it. But I really respect you, and I love the person you are, and I'd love to stay in contact, Fred, and keep this conversation going with you.
That would be great. I'd love that. I feel like it's really part of the healing. When you did ask me, I was like, I'd love to do that. I feel like it's right. And also for me, part of the healing is also helping other people through their grief, if it's fresh, you know. Like, I really feel the need to want to reach out to other people, so thank you.
And I want to meet your dad. I want to I want to join the two Pauls up.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
That'd be awesome. All right. Well, have a good day, hey?
Have a beautiful day, Brent. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Bye.